In 2004, the coast of Aceh, Indonesia, was essentially erased by a catastrophic tsunami.
Yeah, just absolute unimaginable devastation.
Right. And, you know, by all conventional logic, a region subjected to that level of destruction should have its economy crippled for a generation.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, your infrastructure is washed away, human capital is tragically lost, and the entire productive capacity of the area is effectively reset to zero.
Exactly. But here's the crazy part. When you look at the data a decade later, the hardest hit districts were actually wealthier than they would have been if the wave had never hit at all.
It is it's a profound macroeconomic paradox, because the instinct is to look at a natural disaster purely as a subtraction problem.
Right? It's just tallying up the lost buildings and destroyed crops.
Exactly. But when a catastrophe triggers this unprecedented global response, in this case, a massive $7.7 billion reconstruction effort, the regional economy transitions into a completely different phase.
You're no longer just measuring the initial destruction.
No, you are measuring a huge, concentrated injection of capital that essentially rebuilds an outdated economy with modern infrastructure.
Welcome to a new deep dive. Today, we are exploring the rigorous empirical methods required to evaluate the long-run economic impact of localized natural disasters.
And we're using the 2004 Aceh tsunami as our central quasi-natural experiment for this.
Right. So for you, the listener, whether you are a graduate student in economics or just fascinated by causal inference, this is your methodological study guide. We are grounding our discussion in a tutorial called Aceh's Causal Recovery, Modeling Disaster Impact in Python.
Which is a beginner's replication of a highly cited 2019 paper by Hager and Neumeier. But before we get into the estimators, there is an essential methodological disclaimer we have to establish.
Very important, yes. Let's hear it.
The data set used in this specific tutorial is synthetic. It has been explicitly calibrated for teaching purposes to reproduce the original paper's signs, statistical significance, and approximate magnitudes.
So it allows you to run the Python code and see the statistical mechanics function in real time, but it's not the raw, confidential World Bank or satellite data.
Exactly. The mission here is to master the empirical strategies, not to formulate novel macroeconomic policy about Indonesia based on training data.
Fair enough. So we are going to methodically unpack four distinct analytical approaches today. Difference in differences, continuous dose response functions, the synthetic control method, and finally, spatial standard errors.
Right. And the underlying challenge connecting all of these is the fundamental problem of causal inference.
Because how can we credibly measure if Aceh was richer or poorer a decade later, when we only observe the universe where the tsunami actually happened?
Right, we have to computationally build the counterfactual.
Yeah.
But before applying any advanced Python libraries, we must validate our identification strategy.
We have to prove that this event qualifies as a quasi-experiment.
Yes, and that relies entirely on exogeneity. The tsunami was a massive external shock. The specific sub-districts that flooded were dictated strictly by geographic and bathymetric variables.
Like coastal elevation, the depth of the offshore ocean floor, mangrove vegetation, things like that.
Exactly. Nature assigned the treatment, not human economics. A district didn't flood because it had poor institutional governance or sluggish industrial output.
Which is crucial, right? The randomness of the geography allows us to cleanly divide the map. So we have a treated group of 10 flooded districts and a control group composed of 13 non-flooded districts within Aceh.
And an additional 76 districts across the rest of the island of Sumatra.
Right. Now, our primary outcome variable for this evaluation is the annual growth rate of real district GDP. But we deliberately exclude the oil and gas sectors from this calculation.
Yeah, that's an important detail. Oil and gas are globally liced commodities. Their revenues are highly volatile and largely detached from local ground-level economic activity.
So including them would just introduce massive statistical noise.
Exactly. It would easily obscure the localized impact of the disaster and the reconstruction.
Okay, so with the treated group, the control group, and the outcome variable defined, the standard initial approach is to set up a basic 2x2 difference in differences model.
Right. The duty.
You take the average GDP growth of the flooded districts before and after the 2004 shock, do the same for the non-flooded control districts, and subtract the differences to isolate the effect of the tsunami.
And this foundational model rests entirely on the assumption of parallel trends. The expectation is that In the absence of the tsunami, the flooded and non-flooded districts would have continued on the exact same economic trajectory.
The source material uses a classic textbook analogy here, which I love. Imagine two runners on parallel tracks.
Right, the runners.
The starting gun fires.
Yeah.
And both runners speed up due to the overall national economic climate. That's the baseline trend. But if we intervene and give one runner specialized coaching, which represents our reconstruction treatment, we only credit the extra burst of speed that specifically separates them from the uncoached runner.
Exactly. You are measuring the gap between their relative accelerations. But here is the problem. The basic 2x2 model completely fails to capture the reality of a natural disaster.
Wait, really? Why?
Because it treats time as a simple binary. If you implement this pooled model on the data set, it produces a coefficient of plus 0.0125, and it is entirely statistically insignificant.
Wow. So mathematically, it suggests the tsunami and the subsequent $7.7 billion aid package had zero measurable impact on growth.
Which exposes the severe limitation of pooling time periods into just before and after. A natural disaster of this magnitude is not a static, singular event. It's a sequence of intense, opposing economic phases.
Ah, right. Because in 2005, the local economy absolutely cratered as supply chains collapsed.
Yes. But then from 2006 to 2008, the region experienced a massive, hyper-stimulated construction boom.
So if you force an algorithm to average a historic contraction with a historic expansion, the negative and positive values simply cancel each other out.
Exactly. The pooled average masks the entire economic timeline. To solve this, the empirical strategy must transition to a dynamic difference in differences model.
We need an event study framework that tracks the causal effect year by year. And in Python, this is typically executed using a package like PyFixist to handle high-dimensional fixed effects or the diff-diff library to generate the event study path.
Right. And the implementation requires careful staging. First, we pin our baseline period to the years 2000 through 2002.
Those years are omitted from the regression to serve as our steady state reference point, right?
Yes. Then the remaining timeline is sliced into distinct event time windows. We construct interaction terms for each phase. So, a pre-tsunami phase for 2003 and 2004.
Then we isolate the tsunami shock year, which is 2005.
And then define an active recovery window from 2006 to 2008. And a post-recovery phase from 2009 to 2012.
We regress our GDP growth variable against these treatment time interactions while aggressively controlling for unobserved variables using fixed effects.
Specifically, district fixed effects and year fixed effects.
Which is key for grad students to understand, right? The district fixed effects absorb any underlying time invariant characteristics of a specific region.
Exactly. If a district is geographically isolated or has historically high institutional corruption, the district fixed effect mathematically nets that out so it doesn't bias our recovery estimate.
And the year fixed effects absorb macroeconomic shocks, like a national currency fluctuation that hit all districts simultaneously in a given year.
Spot on. So when we run this dynamic model, the coefficient for the pre-tsunami window comes back at plus 0.0172, but it lacks any statistical significance.
And for an econometrician, that lack of significance is actually the most important part of the output, isn't it?
It really is. It serves as our placebo test. It proves mathematically that before the earthquake struck, the treated districts and the control districts were moving in lockstep.
Going back to our analogy, it confirms the parallel trends assumption. The two drifting boats were riding the exact same economic current before the wave hit.
Exactly. But in the 2005 interaction term, the divergence is violent. The coefficient drops to minus 0.0792, and it is highly significant with a p-value of less than 0.01.
Meaning the flooded districts contracted by nearly 8 percentage points relative to their unflooded neighbors. That is a massive shock.
It is, but then the economic narrative flips. When we look at the recovery period from 2006 to 2008, the coefficient is a positive 0.0628, significant at the 5% level.
And this specific metric is our average treatment effect on the treated, or the ATT, right?
Yes, the ATT. But we have to be very precise about what that represents. It is the specific growth premium experienced by these exact flooded districts, caused exclusively by an extraordinarily well-funded reconstruction effort.
So it doesn't imply a universal law that destroying infrastructure inherently creates 6% growth.
Definitely not. The context of the intervention dictates the ATT. However, there's a glaring demographic vulnerability in this finding.
Right, the population loss. Over 130,000 individuals tragically died, and hundreds of thousands more were displaced.
Yeah. And a skeptic looking at this model would immediately point out that if your population denominator shrinks drastically, your GDP per capita mechanically inflates.
Even if the total economic output of the factories and farms hasn't recovered at all.
Exactly. So if we don't control for the population loss, our 6% growth premium might just be a tragic statistical artifact of counting fewer people.
So to test this, the model is rerun. We swap aggregate district GDP growth for per capita GDP growth as our dependent variable.
And the results of that robustness check solidify the theory. The recovery gain does not vanish. It actually intensifies.
Wait, really? It goes up?
Yeah. The coefficient for the 2006 to 2008 recovery window rises to plus 0.0827 and retains its high statistical significance.
Wow. So total output did fall in 2005 alongside the population, but during the reconstruction, a smaller population was capturing the output of a heavily capitalized, modernized economy.
Exactly. But, you know, measuring at the district level still presents a granularity problem. A district level aggregate averages out massive internal disparities.
Right, because one subdistrict on the coast might be entirely leveled, while a subdistrict 20 miles inland might experience zero flooding.
So if we want to understand the true mechanics of disaster recovery, we need to test a more precise hypothesis. Did the specific subdistricts that were hit the hardest actually rebound the most?
But moving to the subdistrict level introduces a severe data constraint, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The Indonesian government simply didn't calculate reliable GDP figures at that micro level in the early 2000s.
They didn't. So we have to substitute GDP with a proxy variable, which is satellite nighttime luminosity.
The theory being that economic activity, you know, running factories, illuminating roads, that generates light that can be captured by orbiters.
Right. And the data set utilizes DMSP OLS digital numbers to quantify this light. But you cannot just take the average brightness of the pixels in a subdistrict.
You have to sum the digital numbers across all the pixels within the boundary, right?
Yep.
To keep the night lights conceptually aligned with GDP, which is an aggregate measure of total output.
Exactly. Additionally, nightlight data is heavily right skewed. A few urban centers are blindingly bright, while vast rural tracts emit almost zero light.
So to stabilize the regression and prevent extreme outliers from distorting the model, we apply a natural logarithmic transformation.
Yes, and because the logarithm of zero is undefined, the methodology dictates adding a microscopic constant, specifically 0.001, to every observation before transforming it.
Got it. So with the luminosity proxy established, we can discard the binary treated or untreated dummy variable and introduce a continuous dose response function.
Right. We measure the actual fraction of a subdistrict's population or its land area that was physically submerged.
I think of it like a medical intervention. A minuscule sip of medicine might yield no biological response, but a full dosage triggers a systemic reaction. So the question is whether every incremental foot of floodwater linearly guarantees more aid and therefore more growth.
And the empirical analysis proves the relationship is not linear. It is defined by a rigid threshold effect.
Ah, so it's not a smooth curve.
No. When the subdistricts are sorted into quintiles based on the intensity of the flooding, the bottom 80%, so quintiles 1 through 4, show absolutely flat growth trajectories. Their recovery coefficients are statistically indistinguishable from zero.
So a moderate flood simply didn't cross the threshold required to trigger the massive international aid apparatus.
Exactly. Only the top quintile, the worst hit 20% of subdistricts, demonstrates a statistically significant economic rebound, registering a coefficient of plus 0.0018.
So the ATT we identified earlier at the macro level is not spread evenly like a blanket. It's intensely concentrated purely in the epicenters of destruction.
Because they became the epicenters of targeted capital influx.
Well,
and this section of the analysis also contains a fascinating warning about measurement scaling.
Oh, right. The tutorial highlights two different coefficients for the continuous recovery period depending on how you measure the dose.
Yeah. If you define the dose as the share of the population flooded, the coefficient is plus 0.0160, but if you measure it by the share of total land area flooded, the coefficient explodes to plus 1.660.
On paper, those look like two entirely different economic outcomes.
But they are the exact same economic outcome. The massive divergence is purely an artifact of scaling.
Because when you map out district boundaries, they frequently encompass massive, unpopulated hinterlands like deep forests or mountain ranges, right?
Exactly. Consequently, even during a catastrophic coastal tsunami, the average share of total land area flooded across the entire data set is only about 1.2%.
So in a regression model, interpreting a one-unit change in the independent variable means modeling a jump from 0% of the land flooded to 100% of the land flooded.
And because 100% inundation is physically impossible in this geography, the independent variable has almost no variance.
So the math mechanically inflates the coefficient to a massive number just to compensate for the tiny fractional changes in the input data.
Spot on. It is a vital reminder to always contextualize the units of measurement before interpreting the magnitude of a coefficient.
That is a great tip. Now let's address a foundational vulnerability in everything we've discussed so far. Both our dynamic GD and our dose response models rely entirely on the rest of Sumatra acting as a perfect natural twin for ACE.
Right.
But what if we can't find a perfect counterfactual in the real world? This leads us to the synthetic control method, implemented in Python via the MilSynth package.
We're moving from relying on natural geography to computationally building a bespoke counterfactual. The synthetic control algorithm is designed to mathematically clone the treated unit.
So it takes the pool of 76 untreated donor districts in the rest of Sumatra and assigns non-negative weights to each of them.
Yes, and those weights must sum perfectly to one. The algorithm's objective function is to iteratively adjust those weights to minimize the pretreatment prediction error, the root mean squared error, or RMSE, between the actual flooded ACE and this new synthetic blend.
It's basically trying to reverse engineer a parallel universe ACE that perfectly shadows the real ACE's GDP path from 2000 up until the wave hits in late 2004.
Exactly.
But my immediate concern with this approach is the risk of overfitting. If the algorithm just finds one weirdly anomalous district in Sumatra that happens to match ACE by pure coincidence and gives it a 90% weight, we haven't built a robust parallel universe. We've just found a statistical fluke.
That is a very valid concern, and it's the primary diagnostic check for any synthetic control model. You must inspect the distribution of the weights.
And how do the weights look in this analysis?
They are distributed broadly and healthily. The top six donor districts combined carry about 62% of the total influence. The single maximum weight assigned to any individual district, which happens to be JANBY 01, is only 0.13.
Okay, so the synthetic clone is a true composite. It isn't reliant on a single point of failure.
Furthermore, the algorithm achieves a remarkably tight pretreatment fit with a root mean squared error of just 0.485.
And because the synthetic combination tracks the real flooded ACE almost flawlessly before the tsunami, we earn the empirical right to trust it as a valid, untainted counterfactual for the years after the disaster.
Exactly. And the divergence after 2005 is visually and mathematically striking. By 2012, the actual flooded ACE sits 18.3% above its synthetic unflooded counterpart.
Which is amazing. We've now utilized two completely distinct statistical mechanisms, a fixed effects panel regression relying on natural control groups and an algorithmically optimized synthetic control, and they both converge on the exact same conclusion.
They do. We have established highly credible point estimates. But, you know, causal inference is not just about finding the estimate. It is about rigorously testing the uncertainty surrounding that estimate.
Right. The standard errors.
Yeah.
And the tutorial issues a critical warning regarding spatial econometrics here. All 10 of our treated flooded districts are tightly clustered together in the extreme northwest corner of the Sumatran landmass.
And that geographic clustering violates the core independence assumption of standard regression models.
Because in standard models, you assume that the error term of District A has no correlation with the error term of District B.
Right. But Tobler's first law of geography states that near things are more related than distant things. If a massive influx of reconstruction capital arrives at the main port, it doesn't just stay in one district.
The supply chains, the labor migration, the infrastructure upgrades, they all bleed across arbitrary municipal borders.
Exactly. The economic shocks are happening to the cluster simultaneously. The source uses a brilliant analogy here of a milling crowd.
Oh, I like this one. If you are surveying a crowd seated in fixed rows in an auditorium, you might confidently count hundreds of independent observations.
Right.
But if that same crowd is up, shuffling around, talking, and influencing each other, those observations are highly correlated. You possess far fewer truly independent data points than your sample size implies.
Exactly. And if we ignore the shuffling and just run default standard errors, the software will assume we have maximum statistical power, leading us to spuriously confident conclusions.
So to mathematically diagnose if our districts are shuffling, so to speak, we apply Moran's eye to the regression residuals. It functions as a spatial correlation coefficient.
And the output yields a Moran's eye value of plus 0.065, accompanied by a p-value of 0.003.
Wow, so that highly significant p-value is a definitive confirmation of positive spatial autocorrelation.
Yes. The residual unexplained growth of nearby districts is explicitly correlated within a given year. The independence assumption is officially broken.
So to correct our inference, we have to implement Conley spatial HAC standard errors.
Right. This specific sandwich estimator corrects for two overlapping types of correlation. First, serial correlation, which acknowledges that a district's economic error term this year is naturally correlated with its own error term from last year.
And second, it corrects for spatial correlation, penalizing the model for the fact that different districts located within a specified radius, in this case 100 kilometers, are influencing each other in the exact same year.
The application of the Conley HAC correction is a true testament to academic integrity. We are actively choosing to make our test harder to pass.
But when applied, the point estimate for our recovery premium remains mathematically identical, right? The $7.7 billion aid effect is still calculated at plus 0.0628.
It is, but by properly accounting for the correlated geography, the standard of error surrounding that point estimate jumps dramatically. It expands from a naive, uncorrected 0.0146 to a rigorous 0.0244.
So we are intentionally widening our margin of error, but doesn't that expansion risk dropping our t-statistics so much that the recovery premium completely loses its statistical significance?
It is a mathematical risk, absolutely, but honest inference demands it. In this specific data set, the t-statistic drops from over 4 down to 2.57.
Okay, so the statistical significance of the ACE recovery finding shifts from the 1% level to the 5% level.
Exactly. The effect is robust enough to survive the spatial penalty, but our certainty is appropriately humbled. A careless econometrician relying on default settings would have overstated their statistical confidence threefold.
That is such a crucial final step in the workflow. Let's summarize the analytical journey for your study guide. By triangulating a dynamic difference in differences model to capture time-varying phases, a continuous dose-response function via satellite luminosity to measure localized intensity, and an algorithmically robust synthetic control to build a bespoke counterfactual, this analysis proves a distinct macroeconomic reality.
Right. A localized catastrophe, when met with a heavily capitalized, well-coordinated reconstruction effort, can actively shift a region onto a higher long-run economic trajectory.
Methodologically, it proves that pooling time periods obscures the nuanced phases of a shock. Scaling artifacts can drastically distort continuous variables, and when treating geographically clustered units, employing spatially corrected standard errors is absolutely non-negotiable for credible inference.
Beautifully summarized. But you know, causal inference is an ever-evolving puzzle. We want to leave you with a final, highly theoretical challenge to ponder for your own modeling.
Yeah, the source material notes a fascinating caveat at the very end. When the model compares the flooded ACE districts exclusively to the non-flooded ACE districts, completely excluding the 76 districts and the rest of Sumatra, the recovery premium effectively halves and loses its statistical significance.
And the reason for that drop touches on the complex issue of general equilibrium effects. Because the $7.7 billion in reconstruction capital didn't just hit an invisible, impenetrable wall at the boundary of the flooded districts.
Right. The massive demand for labor and materials spilled over into the neighboring non-flooded regions of ACE. The economic cure bled into the adjacent control group.
Exactly. Which means the control group inadvertently became partially treated by the intervention you were trying to isolate.
That's wild. So the challenge for you, for future empirical modeling, is this. When the economic shockwaves of a localized disaster and its subsequent aid injection naturally decay across a map, how do you mathematically ensure your counterfactual remains truly untainted?
Right. How do you measure the healing when the medicine is in the groundwater?
That is the analytical puzzle you will have to solve next. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.